History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold, and they don't have to. All we need to do is ask a few questions and take the time to listen to what comes back our way from some of our more experienced neighbors. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm in Fresno, California today with 100-year-old Dorothy Jones. 100. That's a big number. And you just had a 100th birthday party here recently.
Oh, boy, that was fun. That was great. All the neighbors came. Of course, we couldn't come into each other's homes and all that sort of thing. But the neighbors flocked in. All the representatives from the Honor Flight, that was a wonderful experience, too. We just had a great time, and it was a gorgeous day. It was November 29th, and that was a Sunday, and the good Lord sent sunshine and beautiful day, and I couldn't ask for a better 100th birthday. I recommend it to everybody.
And we'll all try to take you up on that or follow your advice. And, you know, there was a little local news coverage of that. And since then, people have been wanting to talk to you. You've heard from folks even in other countries?
Honestly, this is mind-boggling. Yes, someone in England is pulling together a story of World War II, because so many of the World War II people have gone off to heaven already. And yeah, we got from there, and two or three from the states here. Iowa, the man and I are getting quite chummy corresponding with each other. And the father of one of my neighbors who lives in North Carolina, and he heard me from that station there in Statesville, North Carolina. So we've been corresponding. And that's the only thing I do is write, because I don't use the email or the sort of thing that, and I see you have an Apple gadget there, and I don't do that sort of thing. I just write and talk, and that's it.
Well, it seems to be working just fine.
Works fine. I haven't stopped it yet.
And I'm glad you had room in your busy calendar to squeeze me in to talk to you here today with all the requests
ideal.
You're getting.
Ideal.
And you've lived here in Fresno for a long time, but this is not where you grew up. Tell me where you grew up and what your childhood was like.
Okay. Oh, I was born and grew up in South Carolina and was at the very end of the Great Depression. So I know what it's like to be living in a time when jobs were scarce. My father was a barber, and Lord knows, barbers didn't make much money. And there were six of us kids, which gave a pretty, it worked. We were church-going people, but we were also poor as church mice, and that worked fine, too. And then we all grew up.
Well, and, you know, considering that, I imagine your childhood was a little different from the childhood your children had here in Fresno. And maybe you told them a story or two over the years of the chores you had to do or the way you guys had to make do in those Depression years. Anything you want to share with us?
Oh, man. It's a different world completely. And I wonder what the next 100 years is going to bring for the next generation to go into that. Yeah, it was different. We lived, I won't say hand to mouth, but when you learn to live without, because you've never had the types of things that kids have today, thank goodness they have it much better. And I hope they realize it. And I hope they will continue to realize it, because we grew up with not too much, but every little advancement was a great help. I think of my mother doing all her own work, and I think if she could only have had, I have, or I did until this, I always say it wrong,
The pandemic?
Pandemic. I always say it wrong, and then I've used a very vicious word. But I had a little girl come in every 2 weeks to vacuum and do the types of things that I have trouble getting over to do anymore. But my mother did all that, and as we grew up, we learned what it was like to scrub a floor or wash a window or take out garbage and do all the things that had to be done, and they got done.
I'm thinking about how different the world is, not just for everybody, but specifically for women. Young girls today may have different kinds of dreams and ambitions than you had as a young lady there in South Carolina. Do you remember having a dream that, hey, one day this is what I'm going to do with my life or make of myself?
Yeah. I used to think, now this is back in 1920 and 21 and 22, and as I grew up, it got a little older in school, I thought, California, would I love to see California. It was just as far away as it is going to the moon now, you might say. And gradually you find yourself. I was the first one, actually, in my family who graduated high school. And as things were at that time, that was as far as I dared even hope. I would love to have gone on to college, but I couldn't afford it. Jobs were scarce. But I was able to get a job. I'd taken the commercial courses in high school and was able to type and take shorthand and do that sort of thing. Well, I was 2 years before I even got that job. So once I started working and helping financially at home, then my two older brothers were helping too. And things began to lighten up considerably. And it wasn't until World War II came along that jobs became available. And it's sad to think that, but things were beginning or had been bubbling in Europe for a while. And it was obvious that it wasn't going to stop there. And I continued to go to my little work and type my little typing up and all that sort of thing. I've graduated high school in 1938. Then the war came along into our country because we knew from the news and things were happening that it was not going to stop there. And when Pearl Harbor came along, I was at the right age and the right temperament to, hey, this is going to go over again, so let's go see what that's all about. And a certain amount of patriotism and a certain amount of curiosity and a certain amount of maybe just plain get out there and see what's happening. And so one day in the Charlotte paper, after I'd been out of high school 4 years, 21 now, there was an article in the paper to the effect that a naval officer would be in Charlotte, which was 25 miles from my hometown down across the South Carolina line. And by golly, it said, any women between the ages of so-and-so and so-and-so, unencumbered with husbands or children or whatever, could call up and go up and for an interview if you're interested in going into the Navy. Well, hey, that was not an auxiliary thing. It was just like the boys going in. But the reason they needed women to go in, girls to go in then, was to relieve the men who were doing the kinds of jobs that women could do, such as office work. And some of the boys were, I'm sure, happy to get out from under that kind of work and put on a fighting uniform and go and serve aboard ship or to one of our islands. At that time, which we didn't know, the Japanese had armed quite a few of the islands down in the Pacific. And you know it now, we know it now. So we went in, I went to Charlotte, and I passed all the little tests, aptitude test and health test and all that sort of thing. And in October of 1942, I left Charlotte and Rock Hill and went to Stillwater, Oklahoma, where they'd taken over a college there as a training base for prospective Navy women. Ha-ha! So we were fitted for uniforms and thought we looked. I never thought I would wear anything designed and provided by the main Boucher stylist, but I did, and we looked good.
And this was a brand new thing. I mean, President Roosevelt only allowed this a few months earlier, so you were a trailblazer. You were one of the first women to sign up for this, and that was such a big deal. They decided to put a picture of you in the paper. Now, this picture here of all these young ladies on the train. I mean, you guys are on the caboose, and here's these sailors saying goodbye to you.
That's what I get from hauling pictures off the wall upstairs and bringing them down here and showing off. Yes, it hadn't happened before. And Mr. Roosevelt, as well as Eleanor Roosevelt, who has always been my ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I had lunch with her one day.
Really?
Yes, I did. Another story, but it's a good story. Anyway, we went up to Charlotte, and we were sworn in right there. It was, as I said, it was October of 1942, which sounds ancient now, doesn't it? That was a long time ago. And away we went to Stillwater, Oklahoma, for 2.5 months or so of training.
Mm-hmm.
It was training the Navy way of writing letters, the Navy way of setting up your everything. And as I said before, and I'm very proud of this, we were not an auxiliary or a helpful. It was just exactly as the boys were. Of course, they had flocked to the recruiting stations by then, because once Pearl Harbor was attacked, everybody became very patriotic and ready to put on a uniform of some kind and go and protect our country. So there we went. I wonder sometimes, really, what would happen today if we had that same sort of thing to look at today.
Mm-hmm.
If we have the same sort of love of our country, and after that thing in Washington, I don't know what we would expect. But people were ready to do what they could do. Of course, the women were not trained to carry a gun or shoot a gun. We were not that kind of helpers. We went in to relieve a man so he could go and do that.
So you mentioned the attack on Pearl Harbor. I'm always interested. It seems like everybody has distinct memories of where they were and how they found out about that. Do you have a memory like that?
Indeed, I do. We had just come home from church. Now, this in South Carolina, which the timing was entirely different then. It was over in the early afternoon. My mother and I were in the living room, and my youngest brother had gone in the kitchen to see what he could delve out of the dinner in there before dinner was served. Dinner was at noontime, you know. I'm from the South.
That right. Was, that's
not
dinner.
Luncheon. Still dinner. So he came into the living room with a puzzled look on his face, and he said, "You know, something strange is happening someplace. There's a place called Pearl Harbor." We had never heard of Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
Pearl Harbor. And he said, "I think there's a war going on, and it's our soldiers and things." So naturally, we turned on, and we got the message right then that Pearl Harbor was being attacked. All the joy kind of went out of our lives for a while, because we didn't know where they were going from there. And I don't think they did either.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of that day, and I thought we had so little protection at that time. And they wiped out practically all the Navy we had. All the battleships were there in a row, and they just burned the heck out of them. And there's still people. I've been back there since, of course. But there's still sailors down under that in the Arizona and the other battleships.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't any fun for them. And everything took a change then. We were in the war, and my little job typing away in the office where I'd been. So that's when I saw the ad in the notice in the paper that women would be accepted, and away I went.
And you mentioned six kids in your family.
Yes.
How many of those six ended up serving in the war?
Three of my brothers and myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had a sister who was married at the time. And then my oldest brother did not serve but the rest of us served in different branches. I was in the Navy until my brother, 2 years older than I, who had been, what is it, when you don't pass the, he had a hearing problem.
4F?
4F.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, that just was the most heartbreaking thing for him. So he was accepted then after I'd been in for 6 months or so. And he came, he was accepted, and he served aboard ship. Ran into him in Hawaii when I was stationed there. His ship came into Hawaii. And I got leave and went up, and we had a great time getting
Wonderful.
Reacquainted. And a brother who was in the Air Force, and he was in India, and they flew over the hump
mm-hmm.
there. That youngest brother then, who told a whole bunch of lies and went into the Marine Corps because he wasn't old enough. And he went into the Marine Corps, and of course he was in some of the invasions in some of the islands down there.
So how old was he?
Well, he was 16, but he was going to be 17 eventually. And I guess they wanted, and he was a big, strong boy. He was a football player and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he did well, and he grew up there, you might say.
And they all made it through the war okay?
All made it, and my brother-in-law, the sister I told you about, was married, and her husband had been in the National Guard, and of course he was called up right away. Mm-hmm. So we had plenty of stars in the window. At that time, if you had someone in the military, that you could put a little star in your window. And my mother's window was pretty much full of stars. But we all got home safely and telling each other a bunch of war stories, and that was fun too. But I was in there almost 4 years.
And I've got to ask you too, since you mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt was someone you looked up to, and she did advocate for women's roles.
Yes.
Another thing that she gained some acclaim for is how she advocated for African-Americans to serve.
She did, indeed.
And to fly.
Yes.
Growing up in the South, in Rock Hill, I just out of curiosity, were those schools, your high school, would that have been a segregated school?
Much to my sorrow. And when I go back there and see my high school, and it was that way. Mm-hmm. It was that way. But she did, the two of them, were people of their time. I think the person appears when we need him most. And I think at that time, America needed people like the Roosevelts. And thank heavens they did, because they did.
It's time for our first break, but we still have to get to that story about when Dorothy met Eleanor Roosevelt, not to mention more of her adventures in the Navy. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos of this centenarian now, as well as what she looked like back then. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable. Or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our captivating conversation today with 100-year-old Dorothy Jones of Fresno, California, originally from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Nearly 80 years ago now, she became one of the first American women to volunteer for Navy service in World War II. How were you treated as a woman around all these men? Because 16 million Americans in the armed forces, but only 300,000 of them were women. And
that
you
was
were
great.
One of the first. Good odds or what?
That was super. Yeah. I was not a particularly attractive girl. You wouldn't believe it now. And I had a rather low, slow coming to grips with dating and going out, and even before the war with this stuff. Mm-hmm. But boy, you're suddenly in war, you're surrounded by guys, and they adored us because they weren't accustomed to women being in the same mess hall. Of course, you didn't share any kind of barracks or that sort of thing. They were very, very separated. And we honored that, and so did the boys. The boys were great. And when they finally, after I was made a recruiter, which was a fun job because you drove all over from Atlanta up to Charlotte, across to Knoxville, Tennessee, and it was great. And Charleston, South Carolina, which is my favorite town in the whole world.
Is it?
That is the greatest. And someday when I grow up and take over my own life again, I'm going to live in Charleston, right there. It's a lovely town. And so I did that until another little notice came out in our own directives, saying that women who are interested in applying for transfer to Hawaii. Now, at that time, Hawaii was not a state. Mm-hmm. It was a territory. And when this little notice appeared. I'm a great one for reading things in the newspaper and going after them. So there's women who were interested in applying for duty in Hawaii, and I did indeed apply for the Hawaiian thing. And then I was sent out here for the necessary training again to go there and get the certain shots that were inoculations to keep us healthy.
So you finally got to see California, which you
dreamed
about.
No, not as much of it as I planned to or wanted to. Yeah, I did get my desire to come to California. And, of course, our traveling was done on trains or buses because they were not flying people all over like they do today.
Mm-hmm.
You were strictly on a train, and for the first time I slept on a sleeper in a Pullman train. That was an experience in itself, you know. So whatever comes along new brings its own different experiences, and you learn to take advantage of them. So I loved it. And then to Hawaii, and of course that's next thing to going to heaven or to Charleston, South Carolina. It's a nice place to be. Mm-hmm. And I was stationed down on the big island of Hawaii. It was a place, if I'd had a lick of sense, I would have invested my simple little Navy pay in some property there and had a little place to go when I'd want to now. Where I was stationed is a big golf course.
And what were you doing there?
I was the secretary. By this time, I'd done enough office work that I was quite proficient in what I was doing. And I was secretary to the OD, the officer of the day. My office was right where you'd come into the administrative office's doors, and everybody had to check by and look at their little ID and be sure they were all right, not our enemies. And that was fun. And I met the nicest people in the world, both in the Navy training, the girls, the women that were in there, because we had eliminated all those that we were told if somebody comes during the recruiting thing. If somebody applies and you talk to them and you give them the test and you check their credentials and all that, if it's somebody you would not like or enjoy being stationed with or being roomed with or whatever, there's lots of ways they can be eliminated. And I must say I did put some of them on my own elimination, because if there's somebody you don't want to spend 24 hours a day with and you can get them off your list, you do it. And I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad.
Were there any aspects of your work there that were challenging for you?
Actually, there wasn't. There wasn't. Of course, your way of life changes completely when you're controlled by time and leave days and no leave days and so on. You learn that sometimes you're not the real controller of where you'll be today and tomorrow and the next day. And you learn to accept it and go as you are. Mm-hmm. But again, as I've said before, and I will continue to think that, it was just the personnel that got away from that small town of Rock Hill, which was a nice little town. I'm not putting it down.
Mm-hmm.
But to room with people, one of my roommates was from Lake of the Woods, Minnesota. And she was such a nice gal. And we learned from each other. We learned what our own backgrounds had been and where we'll meet later after the war. Because we didn't know how long that war was going to go on.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know. And, of course, as soon as it was finished, as soon as the European war and then the Japanese war was finished, the government started trying to get their people home, because that was expensive, flying those people all those years. And in no time at all, I was on a train going back to Rock Hill, South Carolina. And I worked for the VA there. We were just opening a Veterans Administration office in Rock Hill. And boy, that's when we learned what some of the veterans had gone through. It wasn't all peaches and cream for some of them, because they would come into our VA office and we helped where we could there, with whatever their problems were, whether they were medical or insurance-wise or educational-wise. There were tons and tons of opportunities for veterans right after the war. And there still are, really.
I was just thinking about what you said earlier about your mother had so many stars in the window, you could barely see through the window. And one of those was for you. And I'm wondering if you got a sense for how she felt about that. Because everybody's sons were going off to war. But to have her daughter, you know, what, 5,000 miles away in Hawaii from South Carolina. How does she feel about that?
Well, I know, especially from talking to her afterwards, that she would have preferred that I stay at home and keep my little job going at the printing and finishing company where we were taking care of cloth made out of cotton that was grown right there. She took a rather dim view at first because she didn't know exactly what I was going into, and I didn't either. But she had a certain amount of daring do about her, too, and she accepted what came along. Yeah, she was pretty proud of all her in-service family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that when you got home and you worked at the VA that you really saw what some of the guys had mm-hmm. gone through. But I'm wondering, in those years, while the war's going on and you're in uniform, what was your perspective about what you were doing and why it mattered? Maybe the significance of the work that you were mm-hmm. doing.
Well, we did realize that we were an important part of the overall picture, because as more and more women did come into the military, we realized that we were there primarily to release, and this was it true, to release a man for duties that we could not perform and would not be asked to. Mm-hmm. That's why when I look at the women going into the military now, I wonder what their object is and where they came from and where they're going. I did spend some time down at Lemoore Naval Air Base here when my husband was still with us, and I would see more and more girls going into, and some of the things we were very particular about, the length of our hair, and my goodness, we had to walk around the room a dozen times so they could check, the ones in charge could check the length of our skirts. At that time, we were not wearing slacks, and like I'm wearing today, slacks and pants. We were strictly in those uniforms, and they had to be the same distance from the floor. They measured right up, and if they were too long, another fourth of an inch would do it, you know. And it was such a difference, and I see the girls down there now, and they've got a pin to hold their hair up off their neck. But no, they were the first group. That's the first group that had done that, so we marched a pretty straight line, as you say.
Have you had a chance, you know, in those years since, to interact with women who have served in our armed forces since you and gotten a picture for the trail that you all blazed?
Yep.
And what that means to women in the mm-hmm. military today?
It just happens I have a niece, a great niece, who went into the military when she could. And I'm afraid I was the reason for it. She always had a great deal of respect and honor when she was a little girl and I was a big girl. And then she did indeed, when she finished school, she went into the Army, and she has stayed in there, and she has stripes up and down her arms that she's a chief master sergeant. She will have a retirement that will make you and me and Mr. Trump all look like on real welfare, because she has stayed right with it. And I wonder about people that do that, because there's another life outside the military. It's fine and dandy when you're needed and there's a place for you. But I don't think I would have made a lifetime career military person. It was fine while it lasted. But my roommate, who was from Stockton, nicest gal in the world, and that's what she used to say. She said, we were just doing fine in Hilo, Hawaii, where we were, and some smart aleck ended the war and we had to come home. But we laughed about that a lot. And we did go home and we picked up our lives. And then we met, I didn't know Shannon, my husband, while I was in. I got acquainted with a lot of great guys, really great guys, and had a couple of near misses here and there, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I came out, he was my boss. He was manager of the VA office in Stockton. And I came out with the idea of going on to Japan and being there for the, what do you call it, when you re...
The occupation?
Yes, that. And that she and I had that in mind, because we had had a good time in the military. But then I met him, and she met somebody, and Shannon and I then were married and started raising a family instead of going on to Japan. Mm. And thank goodness we did, because Shannon was working for his doctorate at Stanford at the time I met him. course, he had been a commander in the Navy. And I was a yeoman. I was a typist. So he was a school administrator, too. So he was running both the things at the same time. So every time he would be ready to take the orals and get the doctorate from Stanford in education, I would turn up pregnant. So I had four children within every 2 years I'd have another wonderful child. The world's been awfully good to me, awfully good.
Well, tell me the story of how you and Shannon met. I mean, you said there'd been a few near misses during the war, so you'd met plenty of good guys, but was it about him?
Well, as I said, I was thinking I was going on to Japan, maybe, and that's why I came out after the war was over, and I was back home working for the VA, and the girl who was my roommate from Stockton, she and I were corresponding crazy, and we thought it would be fun then, because we had so much fun in the Navy and meeting all those wonderful people, that maybe it would be fun to go on and live in Japan for a while and work there and help them get back on their feet. Ho, ho, ho. So when I came out to apply for the transfer for my job with the Veterans Administration from South Carolina out here to Stockton, the handsome man across the desk from me, I noticed, didn't have on a wedding ring. And he was a little older than I, but not much. And so we started my desk where I was doing my work. I was hired and transferred and became a VA employee in Stockton. Well, his desk where he was running the office from was maybe 30 feet from my desk where I was typing, and I was assigned to the medical department and keeping records of some of these guys who had come back with medical problems. And that's why then we decided we both liked to play tennis. We didn't think the people in the office knew we were doing this, because he was manager of the office and I was a lowly typist. We liked to play tennis, and we liked Chinese food, and we attended the same church, and that was good. His folks lived here in Fresno, and we were right there in Stockton, so all the points seemed to be going in the right direction. And I met him when I came out in August, and at Christmas time, we were getting a little bit past the hand-holding stage, and then we were married in March. Strike while the iron is hot. I think that's a...
That's your advice, huh?
That's my advice.
You mentioned typing up the medical conditions of some of these veterans. Mm-hmm. Was that eye-opening for you? Were there some things that you'd have to type about that really got to you emotionally?
Yes, it did. And so many of them. I was not a trained psychologist. I didn't know what anything to do with the mental condition. But just being there and taking their story down, I learned that a lot of people who had apparently gone into the military with everything intact came back with mental problems. But then we're working primarily with male veterans. It was a rare thing a woman veteran would, because heck, we went home, got married, and started raising children, and the war was finished, and we were back in our normal way of life by that time.
And speaking of the war ending, you mentioned, you were in Hilo when the war ended.
Yeah.
Was that cause for celebration? Was there a big reaction to that news?
Oh, golly. Oh, yes. Of course, we hadn't been in any danger out there for some time, and we had our little social life. There was dances on the base, and a girl who had been a professional musician sang at these things. When that came across on the news, it caused a lot of hooray, hooray, we're going home type of thing. Because when people have been away from home, even a little town like Rock Hill, South Carolina, it's good to go back home and find that things are like you left them, and maybe you had something to do with it, or maybe you didn't. And most of the kids that were my age when I left had gotten married, and my gosh, had started families and all that sort of thing. And that's when I made the decision to further it by going on further with some kind of interesting life and meeting Shannon and deciding to get married and be a normal human being again.
Did Shannon ever tell you much about what he had done during the war?
Well, he had some pictures. He was stationed down in New Guinea, and they went in at one time just after MacArthur had been ousted from there. So he had some, because it got pretty hot down there. They were just away off the coastwise of Australia, and they were in some, those Japanese had kept coming. It looked like they were going to, a never-ending stream. He did, but he was never injured. Thank goodness. And he came back with the same mental processes that he went in with. And so we were lucky.
Time for another break, but we're not done yet with 100-year-old Dorothy Jones. We still have to hear how she met Eleanor Roosevelt and what kind of impression the First Lady made on her. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our delightful visit with a young lady whose neighbors have dubbed her the Mrs. Rogers of the neighborhood in Fresno, California. Dorothy Jones grew up in South Carolina. During World War II, she became one of the first women to join the WAVES, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service in the Navy. When they said WAVES were eligible to serve overseas, she volunteered to go to Hawaii, where she was stationed at Hilo on the Big Island. Did you get to explore much of that island?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. As I told you, all those wonderful guys were there. There were not too many women when we were sent down there. Not too many had been sent over at that time. And the most of them, like in, when we finished our training in Stillwater, Oklahoma, any of the girls who were doing typing and record keeping, that's all sent to Washington, D.C. That's where they needed them, you know, and all those Pentagon was beginning and all the records. And oh, I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go to Washington. I'd been to Washington. Great place. I wanted to go to Charleston. And it just happened that one of the boys that were stationed when they set up this training thing for us in Stillwater, Oklahoma, they sent a contingent of Navy guys there who we replaced. And one knew that I was making a to-do, and anybody who listened to me, I want to go to Charleston. And they had a request for one wave to be sent to Charleston. And he changed my record. And I didn't go to Washington, D.C., though, although I was under the impression that I would, along with all the others. And my gosh, when the CO at the base called me down and said, I don't know why this has changed, but your orders show that you are to go to Charleston, South Carolina, and be assigned to the ONOP, that's Office of Naval Officer Procurement. That's how the men who are applying for commissions would go through that office. And some funny little stories happened there. Oh boy, I couldn't wait to get there. And I was treated like a queen because I was the only one. And I corresponded with a lot of people, a lot of guys. And I had a map beside my desk. And I kept little pens in the desk, in the map for guys who were in the Navy. I put blue pens in the Army. I put little red pens in the white ones, I guess Marines, whatever. And one new officer who had gone through our training there, or our selection, And he, now this is over, war had been gone a while, but he was getting his commission. And he went down and had his blue dress uniform tailor-made. He had a little boy about 4 or 5 years old, had one made for him too, just like his. And they came back to my desk one day for some reason. The little boy was looking up at the map with all the pins in it. He said, "Dad, what are all those little pins in the map for?" His father looked at him like he knew exactly what he was saying. "Those are our naval bases, son." So I sat there laughing my head off. Little did he know that all these letters that represented these young wonderful guys I was corresponding with, and I knew what they were in because the color of the map showed it.
You didn't set them straight, though.
Never did. As far as that kid knows, those are our naval bases. So there.
Oh, I love it. Oh, so you did get to explore the island of Hawaii a little
bit. Oh, yes. We had off duty and on duty. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there was a curfew. We had to be back. That's the only time of my whole time in the Navy that I stayed in a barracks. And the Seabees, for the Navy, they're the construction battalion, had built this lovely barracks for us. It was a two-story thing because they knew other girls would be coming, probably. And I had access to a Jeep. And you step in a Jeep, you know how to drive it. So one of the boys from Public Works brought me a license. He typed it up. He got the information. And he typed it up. And here I had a license and that Jeep more or less at my command. So, heck, I could drive any place I... And I'd tell my boss, Mr. McGrath was his name. He was a lawyer from New York. Nicest man. And I said, "I have to go over and pick up something." "Well, you'll be back in time." "Yes, I'll be back. An hour and a half should do it." And I'd go jump in my Jeep and away I'd go. And that was fun. And I could cover pretty... Of course, it's a pretty big island. You couldn't go from the Hilo side all the way over to the side where they grew the coffee.
Kona?
Kona side. You've been there. Yes.
That's my favorite coffee.
You like that?
I love the Kona coffee.
Well, I liked being there. Of course, we'd have that 4 o'clock rain every afternoon, and we'd learn to protect our shoes because, if you remember, things were rationed, and you just couldn't go down to Gottschalk's or any other store and buy a pair of shoes. So when in the rain, we'd run around there with your shoes off, and we didn't have to wear hose there like we did stateside. We had to wear those horribly ugly brownish tan hose with a seam up the back. Oh, man, we'd take those shoes off to protect them from the 4 o'clock rain. Mm-hmm. But it was excellent duty. You can't imagine a nicer place to be.
Did you learn any Hawaiian language?
I learned to say Kanali Aleoni. We decided we'd learn some of the streets' names, and then we would know those Hawaiian words. I guess I've forgotten most of them. But what, at the age I was and the time I was, what an ideal situation.
Now, you said earlier that you got to eat lunch with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, that was when I was recruiting back in North Carolina.
Yeah.
You know, running around there.
So the war's still going on?
Oh, yeah. This is back before the Hawaiian thing or anything.
All right.
And I was going around there near Asheville. You know Asheville, North Carolina?
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful town. And so I was near there. And she was coming there to speak to all the men's clubs presidents. There's a lot of you men having your clubs. You know that? Oh, wow. And so since she was going to be there, I mean, she would go in a little group of maybe two cars and driving all around those mountains and whatever. And so whoever was planning that luncheon for her found out that I was the only woman in uniform, the only wave there. There were nurses and all that. But I was invited to come to this luncheon. So heck, if Mrs. Roosevelt was going to walk across the floor, I was going to see her walk. And I went, and she... She told that she was not particularly pretty, if you remember. So she told this story about herself. She said she was up right outside of town here, not too far in the country, driving through, and there was a house, not the most elaborate looking home, but children were all over and they were waving as she drove by. So she had them stop and she went up to talk with the people of color who lived there. And when she went in, she saw that the rooms were all papered with newspaper. What they would do is make wallpaper from newspapers And they would make a goopy paste with flour and water, and it for warmth. That would keep that was served as wallpaper, and it warmed the house, and it also gave them a cover over whatever the thing was later. And there was several, her picture was there from the newspaper, plastered on the wall. And after they had visited a while, Mrs. Roosevelt said, I commented to the lady of the house. I said, well, I'm flattered. I see you have my picture here on your wall. And she spoke in the vernacular. She spoke as they did when she would tell this story. She said, so the lady said to me, yes'm. She says, I tell these young'uns, if they don't stop sucking their thumbs, their mouths gonna look just like that. And I love that, how any woman could stand up there and tell a story like that to this group of men, and they loved her. They loved her. Of course, I loved her before I ever went. And that's what I like to say, that I had lunch with Mrs. Roosevelt. She was sitting in the very center of this head table, and I was several people, maybe 10 or 12 or so down the line from her. Mm-hmm. But by golly, I had lunch with Mrs. Roosevelt. So there, you can't argue that for a minute. She left her husband at home that day. If there's such a thing as having a hero, and I've gotten so many notes from these honor flight people. Uh-huh. Some of the family members or the people themselves would say, you are my hero. Because I was in the first group that went, and we kind of plowed the ground, I guess, for the ones that would come along later. Mm-hmm. But it worked. They liked it. They liked us. And now, like I said earlier, I don't think I would be that keen on going if you weren't needed, if it were not wartime, if there were not a certain amount of patriotism and knowing you're needed, what your work is. But golly, we send a woman to be the new vice president of the country. There's no limit to what women can do. And I think that was one of the things that broke the door open for them.
And that makes me wonder. I didn't ask you this. Anytime you're the first to do something, there are some people who don't think you should be doing it or you could do it. Mm-hmm. Did you hear any of that negativity or the doubters or the skepticism about what all you ladies were doing?
Very rarely, but occasionally there were. They would come from people. One fellow, he was a Navy chief, and he was in Charleston, in my favorite town. And he said, there's no place in here for the women. Send those women back. Let them work in the hospitals and stuff. He says, we don't need women. And of course, he was voted down right away. And I had a cousin on my mother's side. He didn't see any reason at all for women to go into the military. So he's not my favorite person anymore.
Have you ever thought about how different your life might have been if you had not join the Navy?
I have. I have indeed. I would probably be living in the same little town, going with the boy who I had dated. I was not much of a dater, like I said earlier, but this boy who had been captain of the football team, I had a real soft spot in my heart for him, but he didn't know I existed. But there were a few who did. So I probably would have married somebody, being right there in that same little town, going to the same little church, which was a good church, the Park Avenue Church, doing their summer program for the children. But I feel like I've seen some of the world. I've been to 38 countries. And I think anybody who can, when the opportunity arises, they should make the opportunity to see as much of the world as you can. Like the song says, there's such a lot of world to see, you know. After that little tiny touch of being in Hawaii, my husband and I took a few trips. We went to Japan and down to New Zealand and Australia, which is lovely to see if you go in the right season. Of course, they're upside down, as you know. And Italy is a good place, and all the Scandinavian countries. The little girl that lived across the street came over one day. She was in junior high or whatever. She said, I'm supposed to write a paper on somebody who has been in other countries, and I wanted to list the countries. So she and I sat there, and we started listing the ones. And we got down, and she went home, and she came back then later that day and said, we forgot three. I said, what could we have forgotten? Because I think she said at that time we had 35. She said we didn't put America and Canada and Mexico. of course, if you'd been there. So we expanded our little list to 38 or 39.
Well, there's somewhere else you've been. You've mentioned it a couple times, the honor flight to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
With all these other veterans. And there's a special spot there on that tour specifically for female veterans.
Yes.
What was that whole experience like for you? What really stood out to you?
What stood out to me with that whole flight, now, like I said, I had been to Washington on short trips twice, I think, and didn't see much. And our family drove across. We had a house trailer, and we took the children back there once. And Shannon at that time knew our representative, Bernie Sisk, and he arranged for us to tour the White House and stuff. But anyway, that honor flight was so beautifully planned. And the other veterans, some of them old and grizzled, looking older than I did, it was such a warm thing, that entire trip.
When you went to Arlington and they have that memorial just for women, the Women in Military Service for America.
We saw that, and there we've got a picture. There I am, and a picture of me will sit there until the next war comes along, I guess, and replaced by cute little blonde girls.
None of your children were alive during World War II.
Oh, no.
I wasn't alive. Most of the people listening weren't alive.
Most of you were not.
So what is it that all of us need to understand about what happened then? Why does it still matter?
You don't have to be a veteran to love the country and want the best for the country and for those that come along. I don't know. Being raised by going to church and learning what you learn in church and applying it to the rest of your life, to school and whatever you do with your life afterward. We've been lucky. We've been fortunate. I tell you what, up in my bedroom, there's somewhat like that one over your head, little crack in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. The train runs back and it cracks the ceiling from time to time. It's a little crack. And when I go to bed tonight, I lie there and I have my conversation with God. And we talk about things. I treasure that little crack in the ceiling. It gives me an opportunity to not do the repeating thing, but when things go a little beyond what I can safely handle, we talk it over.
Well, clearly he's been listening, because here you are, 100 years old, going strong. I'm sure you've been asked this a few times. What's your secret? Because most people don't make it to 100, let alone be able to function this well.
I don't know, other than being blessed with excellent health, and health is very important.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for...
Oh, goodness sakes, it was my pleasure.
I get that sense. I think that comes through. And I know no one else could have told us this story today, but I'm curious, when you look back over 100 years, is there something that you would say that you're most proud of, or maybe you're most thankful for?
I am most grateful and most thankful for the 4 children I have. They're wonderful. Yeah, I'm thankful that I'm this age. I don't know if tomorrow I will not be here. I might fall down those stairs, break my neck. You don't take anything for granted. Never know how long it's going to last, but I might be sitting here on the 150th birthday, and you'll be sitting there thinking, what did she say next? I didn't hear that. What was her name again?
It's a date.
Isn't she something? Dorothy Jones, 100 years old, sharing her unique and powerful perspective. We're out of time, but thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.